this change happen that I'm sure we all want to see with the world events and national events that we see right now. So with that, what I want to do is just say a little bit about Walter. I really don't know a whole lot about him, but I do know that he is the founder of Committees of Safety, and he's teamed up on his board of advisors. You find Dr. Edwin Vieira, the very esteemed honorary chairman of the board of advisors. A lot of you know him. We've had him on past webinars. Also, D.V. Kidd, which we're familiar with. She's written for our publication, as well as she's been a guest on past webinars. I'm sure there are others that are associated with it in various capacities. But rather than get into some long-winded introduction or bio or whatnot, I want to welcome Walter to our webinar and maybe have you, Walter, if you would, tell us a little bit about how you came about, your little kind of encapsulated version of your journey to becoming a whatever you want to call it, a patriot, a freedom worker, mm-hmm. whatever it is, and then how you came to form the Committees of Safety.
Okay. Well, thank you, Earl. Well, I've been an activist probably since high school. I originally got involved when during the Vietnam era, kind of dates me a little bit on how old I am. I grew up as a military brat. My stepfather was in the service for 12 years, and you know, prior early in the 60s, I thought, yeah, Vietnam, yeah, we're going over there to stop communism and spread a communism or whatever. And I was all set. I was actually in the ROTC in high school in North Carolina. We traveled a lot, you know, in the military. My father got stationed every couple of years, Florida, Georgia, North Carolina. And I was actually in the ROTC, Navy ROTC down in North Carolina, junior ROTC. And I moved back up to Connecticut, and that's actually where my family has been for generations, really. That's where we're from. And I saw a whole nother side to it. It was around 1968. And by 1970, I really... It was a weird time for those on the call. I mean, you remember, I mean, our country was so divided then, you know, and I started seeing a whole nother side to this that we weren't really there just, you know, I mean, the whole Golden Triangle with all the drugs coming in. And I started becoming opposed to, you know, to wanting to get out of Vietnam. And I never really could relate, though. I felt very, it was weird because I couldn't relate to the ones, I still loved my country and everything, but I felt the war was morally wrong. And anyway, I started studying the Constitution back then. I had my uncle was kind of my mentor in American history, loved Jefferson and everything, and we started circulating a petition, my girlfriend and I in high school, and a number of us were, and it was for the 18-year-old vote back then. It became, I believe it was the 26th amendment to our Constitution. So that's basically when I started getting active as a constitutional activist. And then again, during the 90s, during the whole Patriot movement then, 10th Amendment, I was living in Hawaii at the time, a small group of us there, we got together and introduced the 10th Amendment, worked with some state legislators there to get that introduced, the 10th Amendment in Hawaii. And Hawaii was, I believe, the first state in 1994 to pass that 10th Amendment resolution. What's going on today with this whole 10th Amendment thing is really great. It's been a resurgence in that again. Back in the 90s, from between 90 and 94 or 96, I think there was about 20 states that passed similar resolutions. But I'm happy to see that this is a reoccurrence again in this whole movement. Let's see, where do we want to go here? We're building on this 10th Amendment anyway, putting some teeth into this. This is the way we're looking at it, putting some enforcement into this 10th Amendment with what Committees of Safety is doing. I met Dr. Vieira about 3 years ago up in New Hampshire at one of a constitutional seminar up there. And he had just come out with his new book, Constitutional Homeland Security. I thought this was great. He went into the depth of it, you know, what the constitutional state militia structure would look like. We got it reinstituted today. It'd probably look more like the Swiss militia system, more like that than anything else. That we just don't have one functioning anywhere properly anywhere in the country today. So for the last few years, I've really learned a lot from him. And Devi's joined us. And what we've done, we've set up these committees of safety throughout most of the 50 states. And it's a grassroots First Amendment organization. We're not a Second Amendment per se. We're not militia. We're not a paramilitary group or anything. We're First Amendment. We're working with a lot of state legislators, trying to educate them and trying to get this revitalized, reinstituted at the state level. It's organized, though, the way it always historically was, at the town and county level, by the people themselves. That's the way we had at Lexington. It was the town of Lexington militia. And it wasn't, there's so much disinformation or not any information out there about what that really was at Lexington, the battle at Lexington, April 19, 1775. It really was very well organized. And it was by colonial statute at the time, and they had been doing this since the early 1600s, organized in this way. And in Massachusetts, it was all males between 15 and 60 were required. It wasn't just the right to keep that military weapon at home, but to bear it when called up, but it was their duty also to keep that at home. So these are the principles we want to reinstitute this on. Like I said, it's from the bottom up. It's the non-commissioned officer would be elected by the people themselves within the town and county. So this isn't a top-down structure that we want to revitalize.
So it's very close to the people. It's at the level that the people are.
Absolutely. And
that's very important.
And what's beautiful about that is, suppose, you know, I want to say something about this Chicago, the new Supreme Court ruling on that, like the Heller case. You know, a lot within our freedom movement feel it's a great win, you know, individual right thing. It's funny, the gun grabbers are also thinking they've won on that, because they're going to get to regulate it right out of existence, you know. And it's just, you know, I don't think it's the right way. That's not what the founders looked at. There's a reason why they put a well-regulated militia is necessary for the security of a free state. Therefore, it's the right. Really, it's a right and duty to keep and bear arms. But it was always connected to this well-organized militia structure. And you don't hear much of that today. And if we had that system reinstituted, it would stop all of this top-down federal regulation we would have immunity from any of that. It would be our right to keep this military weapon at our home, keep it in Barrett, and it'd probably like an M16, you know, fully automatic, and it would have no regulation from the federal. So that's the system we want to get back in place. So okay.
Great. Okay, that's good. It helps to get a little bit of background and understanding on it. Tongue in cheek, but you mean the militia isn't a bunch of men with overblown testosterone running around flashing weapons in the woods and playing army?
No. And a lot of guys. Before I met Dr. Vieira, I never really understood all the colonial, the historical and legal precedent to this, and what the founders really, what they had envisioned, and what they were living, what they were part of during that time when they wrote that. They were all part of that, or had been part of this colonial and then later to be state militia structure. Like Washington was part of the colonial Virginia militia. Most of them had been or were part of that. And, a lot of them may have good intentions, but the media loves to portray it like that, too. I mean, we know that. I mean, they've demonized that word, and they said, yeah, here it is, right here. See, they're all running around in woods. Now, the way it was structured back then, there were independent companies, but they were part of this, either the town or county militia. You know, you could raise independent companies, but we need the state legislators, because it is a state institution. We need them to reinstitute this, which they are derelict in doing right now. That, most of it through ignorance, but...
Well, I was wondering, and noting some things here that you, I guess on a television program that you did about the Oklahoma City bombing, you had Brigadier General Ben Parton.
Yes.
And there's so much there that, of course, people don't know about. And you also had somebody else that I'm familiar with, James Collier, on vote scam.
Oh, yeah.
Those two areas are pretty crucial.
Those were my first two TV shows back in 96. General Parton was a top general in the Pentagon, and this was right after the Oklahoma City bombing, and his expertise was with engineering degrees, and he knew right away that building did not come down the way that they were portraying it. And including a lot of the original news feeds that came out of the local news stations stated there were other bombs inside that hadn't exploded yet. And they later cleaned it up and covered it up. But we still have some of those video footages that were coming out. Those are steel reinforced columns, and the bombs were set inside. It blew from the inside out. The truck bomb was a diversion. Tim McVeigh was part of the military. I mean, the whole thing is just, there's a lot more to it. And now a lot of things are declassified government documents through Freedom of Information that state what was really going on there at Elohim City. There were Southern Poverty Law Center were there, and the whole thing was one set up to demonize what was going on in 95. It reminds me a lot of what we have today, this whole freedom movement, patriot movement, and and they needed to stop it, our enemies, the powers that be, and that's what they did. They blew up our federal building and blamed it on the militias. So
yeah,
for those that remember that.
Yes, that sort of scenario happens in various ways over and over again. It's unfortunate the way that happens. I think, though, that what, and you may concur with this too, I don't know, but at least what I think I'm seeing is that people are falling for that a little less. I mean, more and more people are waking up to the manipulation that's going on and starting to go, wait a minute here, and they have questions that they need answered. More people are finding their voice and stepping forward than I've seen in my lifetime. So that's
Earl, I'd like to say something about the a lot of people are scared away by this well-regulated. They think it's going to be this top-down thing, and it really, they really don't need to be, because if we're all those that are trained in everything and gun safety and training, and that military weapon is at home, we're not going to oppress ourselves, you know. And you know, they couldn't do it back during the Revolutionary War. You know, we had royal governors, even, you know, that were appointed by the king, and they couldn't even. That's what was brought upon the colonial Lexington militia and Concord militia. They tried to do that, and they couldn't do it. You know. It was General Gage, and at Lexington, he was a, you know, the royal appointed governor, and many of them had to leave because we had the firearms. We were organized. The one thing we lack today is that organization at the town and county level, and it's not a private group. They were never private groups that were just off, you know, on their own in the woods or something. You know, they were, the whole town was organized together, or the county. And we don't have that today, unfortunately. We have individuals. And the one, you know, I think it's very short-sighted to think that, especially for a lot of the leaders in this freedom movement, you know, that's not going to work too well when you individually, when we have like 50 guys with black ski masks showing up at your door, you know, claiming to be law enforcement or whatever, that's, you know, yeah, acting outside of the law, and who knows what they are. I mean, I think we all know anyone wearing black ski masks is a terrorist, but, you know, they're claiming to be law enforcement.
Oh, yeah, they're there to protect the rest of the people. Patriots.
But, you know, that theory, that individual, without it alone, individually, without it connected to the organized militia structure, that's not what the founders had in mind, you know?
Absolutely. Well, with your permission, we have some people that have already asked us some questions, and if you'd like...
I'd be happy to. Yeah.
Okay, great. I want to remind everybody that we're speaking with Walter Reddy. He's the founder of the Committees of Safety, which he's been talking about. If you, you know, for those of you that may have joined us late, and if you do have a question for Walter at any time during this webinar, just hit star 2 on your phone keypad if you're on the conference bridge line, and we'll be able to facilitate you asking the question. Or if you're online, then type your question into the small question box. It'd be helpful if you put a first name and city and state so we know who and where, and submit that to us, and we'll make sure the question gets asked. We have one here that from Jim Kirk in Oak Brook, Illinois. And this is one that actually is more for me. How do I tune in online instead of calling in? Well, this is interesting, because to write this question online, they would have had to have typed the question in right underneath the link that they would use to go online. All they had to do was click the link when it was time for the webinar, and they'd be on listening live online. So I'm not sure what happened there. How come that? Maybe we need to find a way to make that a little more clear. Also, we've got Kirk and Riverside. Are we operating under the UCC because we are bankrupt? Have we been deceived into accepting a form of citizenship originally intended only for the residents of D.C.?
I wish Edwin was on that there to take that one. I think I know what he's talking about, but I've had some state legislators that are friends of mine, and the way he explained it, he's a patriot state legislator in New Hampshire, Dick Marple, and the way he looked at it, it's like they're wearing two hats. There's this corporate structure or whatever, and you know, and then there's the sovereign United States of America, these United States and constitutional United States. And I don't know. Edwin may have another take on that. I mean, he's really the most brilliant constitutional lawyer I know. I mean, he's won 3 out of 4 cases at the U.S. Supreme Court level. But that's the way I kind of see it. We just need to assert our rights with, and I think our best shot at winning this, this reclaiming our country, restoring America, is really going to be at the state level. And it's the closest to the people. I don't have a lot of hope in that district or criminals down there. And if we can reclaim these powers, I mean, it really won't matter what they do down there. They could light their hair on fire and jump up and down and pass all sorts of horrendous things. And if we're reclaiming our vital powers, like the Second Amendment and our sound money system that a lot of us are starting to become aware of, the gold and silver, getting back onto that, the basis, we're really going to have the power behind us, the people. So that's my take on it anyway. I don't know if that helped or answered this question.
Sure. I think even in the freedom movement, there's a lot of debate back and forth about what we're really under now, if we are under a declared bankruptcy, and what that means. And then all sorts of things like, you know, dealing with the UCC and the residents of D.C. thing, the admiralty law, maritime law, the fringe flag, all those things. And it debates back and forth. The freedom movement constantly debates that.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, we may even devote a future issue to exploring all of those different subjects and kind of asking the question, patriot myth, lore, or fact, and just exploring it, getting experts on the different sides of it, and presenting information so people can decide, well, what is the truth? What do I believe? So I think that could be healthy. We've got Jay in Detroit. Jay asks, the states have ceded their sovereignty to the U.S. government in the 30s because they were too scared to stand alone, thus letting the present-day system to emerge. Do you think the states have the right and duty to regulate where the senators and representatives of the U.S. government raise their campaign contributions?
Well, I think ideally, and I know this is one of D.V. Kidd's passions, is repealing the 17th Amendment and you know, where the states could actually recall these state senators, these U.S. senators. But I still think, look, I'm believing until the other side, our enemies, come right out and on every corporate media station say, yeah, we've stolen this country, we're under a corporate structure now, and it's bankrupt, and we're your slaves, you know. I'm gonna assert my right under my God-given rights in the Declaration of Independence, the Constitution for the United States. And I think we can get real citizen legislators elected at our state level. you know, and that are really not these professional politicians, but really from the people. I've seen a lot of the document, you know, that they claim that. But let's see them come out and state that they've stole our country. They don't have the courage to do that, I don't think.
yeah, it's doubtful. Jay, for the states on here, wouldn't it be nice if they, SNRs, I assume that's senators and representatives, had to talk with their electors face-to-face? Most of the citizens I know feel that the large sums of campaign funds corrupt the legislative process. Any comments on that?
Well, I agree. I mean, a lot of it, especially at the federal level, you know. I mean, I'll tell you, I think with the limited funds that we have in this economy today and everybody's struggling, I mean, I think we get more bang from the buck by putting it behind the ones within our freedom movement that are running for state legislators or governor. I mean, we've got a great coalition. I live in Connecticut here. I mean, we have about 20 different liberty groups that are working together. We've got really good candidates running for attorney general and that understand the Constitution and want to reinstitute it at all levels there. So I think we get way more bang for the buck than with the... And I've got some friends that are running for, like Rand Paul, running for U.S. Senate down there. I mean, God bless them, too. But, you know, it's just I think we're going to be able to restore this country faster this way through the states. So that's just my feeling on it.
okay. We've got Joanna in Denver. North Carolina. I didn't know there was one. I was thinking it was going to be Colorado, but maybe there's a Denver, North Carolina. In fact, I was from there, from North Carolina, so I don't know. Interesting. How can we find out if there is a militia in our county? Is there any central national organization related to the militia?
Well, first of all, we're not doing... I think I've stated this a lot. We're not forming what committees of safety are about. We're not forming private paramilitary groups calling themselves militias or whatever. We're trying to reinstitute the state militia, okay, and with the state legislators. Organize, I'll repeat it again for anyone that's came on late, organized at the town level and the town and county level. We want to elect our officers among the people, like our town hall meetings or county meetings. But that's the structure we want. And we're really reaching out to a lot of our veterans, too. Because a lot of our veterans that have experience and skills as officers that live within our community could be elected within that structure that we know and trust, maybe, that we personally know. But that is the way it was done historically. Many of those officers within the state militia during the Revolutionary War, where many of them were veterans from the French and Indian War 20 years prior. So this has historic precedent as well as legal precedent to it. Right now, I've been, this past few weeks, I've been talking with some activists out in Arizona, what's going on in Arizona right now. With this invasion on our southern border, a military invasion. I'm talking about just these, you know, workers that want to come around. But a lot of it with what's happened there and some of the military, Mexican military, were trained at Fort Bragg, special forces trained. They go back to Mexico. They partnered with some of these drug cartels, and that's what we have coming across the border. And so what we're trying to do is Dr. Vieira has already willing to come on the phone. Anyone there in Arizona, anyone on the call that knows some of the state legislators or the governor there, Governor Brewer, we're trying to set up a conference call with them to maybe point them in the right direction, how to reinstitute that. It would complement the sheriffs and the police there. That's the way the original colonial and state militia structure was. They weren't adversarial. It even actually complemented the army during, you know, the Continental Army during the war. So this isn't an anti-government a militia group that we want to set up structure. But it is a state institution. There was never anything called a national militia. The Dick Act of 19. We had that system for about 300 years in America. It's only been the last 100 years that we haven't had a functioning state militia since 1903. That's when it started with the Dick Act of 1903 was the beginning of the end of the properly functioning state militia structure. And they severed it. They called the Army National Guard the militia, and everyone else is unorganized in this box, and you're not allowed to organize, and blah, blah, blah. So, we delegated to Congress, and every congressman and every state legislator as of today has been derelict in providing for this system. They never were delegated the authority to unorganize the militia, and that's what they did with the 1903 Dick Act. They unorganized the large majority of the people. So it's an unconstitutional act that needs to be repealed or amended and properly put in. Now on the federal level, and I don't even see that happening, but that is only we've delegated to the power to Congress to call up the state militia only for three specific purposes: to repel an invasion, to suppress insurrection, and uphold the laws of the Union. Otherwise, it's not used as a national level. It's a state institution, so that the officers within the state militia structure can call up the militia or the governor. Does that help at all? I don't know. It really does.
You know, no, that's fine. It really helps us to understand a little bit more about it. One of the things that I see, and we've had Sheriff Richard Mack on the mm-hmm. webinar in the past, and then I see the efforts of what he's doing, and then what mm-hmm. Jack Lamb has done through the years.
Oh yeah.
All of these efforts being correlated in that if folks in the committees of safety or whatever name you want to give it are organized to assist, and then there are those loyal mm-hmm. constitutional type law enforcement and military, mm-hmm. certainly if they're joined together in protecting our constitutional rights and making sure that doesn't go awry, that's a powerful alliance, and they can be very
yep.
helpful towards each other.
Absolutely. We last year, April 19th, Committees of Safety got the permit for Lexington Green, the anniversary there at the Green, Battle Green. And we got the staging area. We invited, well, at the time it was just a blog. It was the Oath Keepers, Stuart Rhodes, and we invited them to come up to it, and Sheriff Mack was there, and we had a great rally there on the green. And, you know, what's interesting, and my family, like I said, was from New England going back to the 1600s here. And with all the colonial militia structure prior to the founding of the country, it was organized in this fashion. And during that time, if you looked at any of the colonial militia statutes in any of the 13 colonies, the sheriff and the constables were actually exempt from militia duty. You know, they had a function that it was under the umbrella of the colonial militia, but it was separate, and they had a separate function and responsibility to do. And I've talked to Sheriff Beck about this. The sheriff's not even a constitutional law. It's not found in the Constitution. But it did serve a purpose in that. And a lot of the states out west, I know there's probably some state or county statutes that are passed, you know, that they're the highest law enforcement there. But in the colonial structure and state militia structure, it actually complemented the sheriffs and the police or constables, the way they called it then. So, but yeah, that's exactly what's needed today out in Arizona. And we're hoping to work with, in that structure, a reinstituted state militia structure, the county level, working with the county sheriffs and the police to stop this invasion going on the border and securing the border, and also working with the, you know, the Border Patrol. I mean, I'm sure they would love to help.
Yes, they could really use it, I'm sure. Mm-hmm. Also have known that in the past that militia members in different areas of the country, when there's been a disaster of some type, have really jumped in and pitched in and helped out, and have been very instrumental, and yet the media won't dare touch that. They don't want to make them look like good guys. They just, you know, give them a broad stroke of their horrific and dangerous and imbalanced. And
yeah, and unfortunately, the way, and I know most of them are patriotic Americans that are involved in that, but unfortunately, because it's a private group, they're infiltrated heavily with agent provocateurs, okay, to discredit it and to, you know, whatever. So that's why it should be organized at the town and county level and very transparent. It's really, if we write it again, Dr. Vieira was talking, it really would include all males and females, like, say, 16 or 18 to 60, would be not just their duty, their right to keep and bear arms, but their duty. And then those that don't want to be part of it, yeah, we could give them exemptions, you know. You pay $50 a year and you get out of it. But it's your duty to keep and bear arms. So, and that would take it out of that venue of being private, you know, and have the full weight of law behind us. We're Second Amendment right there, the way the founders intended it.
That brings up a question. You know, and maybe we can look at that. But if you use the force of law to promote something good, if down the road the force of law, now that it's entrenched into that activity, begins to shift and creates a different intention behind it, can that now then come back and bite you?
Well, okay, we had that system for 150 years when the start of the American Revolution, from the early 1600s to 1775 at Lexington, we operated under colonial militia structures at the town and county level and within the colonies. And what happened was, I stated this earlier, these royal governors did try to suppress the people. They were acting outside the law. They were trying to disarm the Americans at Lexington. But they would, the men that stood at Lexington, there were 50 to 60 Lexington town of Lexington militia men. They were acting within the law. It was the General Gage, the royal governor, that was acting outside the law, and they refused to throw down their arms and to be disarmed. If we, the people, have that on our side, and we're not going to suppress ourselves. We're going to have that military weapon at home, and we outnumber them 1,000 to 1, 1,000,000 to 1 in that structure.
Mm-hmm.
So that's not going to happen.
Okay. Right. Well, I mean, you know, that type of question can come up. People can wonder about that.
Well, I mean, to think about it, are we going to suppress ourselves?
Well, we've certainly done it through our process of who we've elected and what we've allowed to go on. We've certainly repressed ourselves out of ignorance and not being informed.
Yeah, but all political power comes through the barrel of a gun. And if we're organized in this fashion, legally, lawfully, I mean, we're going to have that power.
Right.
I mean, I'm not saying we're going to call for violence or anything, but it's a check on any tyranny. And that's why our founder said it's necessary. If we're going to remain free, we need to have this thing called the state militia structure. If a well-regulated militia is necessary, not optional, not a good idea, it's necessary for it to remain free, a free state.
Mm-hmm.
You could stop it right there. How do you have a free state? Well, it's through this thing called a well-regulated militia, well-organized, really, under these principles.
Exactly. Okay, we've got Barbara in Murphy, Texas. If I wish to start a county-based committee of safety, who do you suggest I contact first, my county commissioner, my county sheriff? If the authorities do not wish to help me, what should I do? I am a beginner patriot, but I can see the urgency of a neighbor organization to be prepared for any disaster from a power outage to a terrorist attack.
Mm-hmm. That's a great question. We're networking with a lot of different liberty groups. We're having at the county level reaching out to these elected officials, or we're running for those offices ourselves, which is really exciting. We have a website, committees. It's plural, committeesofsafety.org. You can find out a lot of information there. You can sign up and network with others in the area. A little more information. Dr. Vieira writes a lot on News with Views. There's a lot of good articles on the background behind it. He's like we said before, he has that book out, Constitutional Homeland Security, Nation in Arms. You can get that at the store page, or you can send a check to him. You can also get it that way. What else? He's in the process of finishing his second book, which is it's really a lot more material there. I mean, I talked to him, I think it was yesterday or the day before. He's doing a lot of editing now, and it's going to be about the body of the book is at least 500 pages with about 300 pages of footnotes and everything. So that's the kind of work he does. It's very well documented. And we're all looking forward to seeing that next book. But I would say what we've done is started these meetings at public libraries and whatever, and try to make that contact with your local officials. A lot of our state legislators live in our towns or the next town over, and if they're not on board and upholding their oath to support the Constitution, we need to get the right ones elected from within our community, you know? So that's what I'd suggest.
Okay. We've got Kevin in Medford, Oregon. Question, what's the best way to prepare a de jure common law government prior to the de facto commercial law government self-destructing, and how important is having constitutional money for barter to keep the economy going?
Well, I'll tell you the first question. I still want to see our constitutional government structure, our constitution restored. I don't believe in secession or anything like. I know there's some debate about that. Dr. Vera has written some good articles on that debate. As far as what was the second question on that one about? Constitutional money as barter, gold and silver. A few of us have put together, and we're just ready to launch us a sister organization. It's called SovereignStateDepository.com, and we're getting this up. We're working with Ron Paul's brother, Wayne Paul, is one of our advisors on this. He's a CPA from Texas. He's been helping a lot, giving us a lot of feedback, as well as Edwin has given us a lot of good advice. But what we're trying to, what we're putting in is a state depository. It's going to be here in Delaware is where we're setting it up. We've set it up. You can go in. We're providing a system where you can, and we're just asking to put a little bit in, try it out. You can sign up at SovereignStateDepository.com, and you'll be able to convert some of your Federal Reserve notes into some gold and silver, and that would be put into your account. And we're going to be buying it in bulk. We're partnering with a few very large gold and silver wholesalers. We're going to pass on that savings a little bit above spot. And we're buying it in bars, okay? And then that amount goes, you can transfer it from your bank account. We're putting in a system where you can transfer some of your Federal Reserve notes through your bank account, like Pay by Phone has, or you pay, you know, electric bill or whatever. It goes into your account that you've set up, and then we're going to have a whole business directory. Businesses that will accept gold and silver. So we're going to be able to, you'll be able to purchase goods and services online electronically using the gold and silver electronically. We can break it down into 1/1000th of an ounce of gold or 1/1000th of an ounce of silver. And it'll complement a lot of what our gold and silver coins are out there now, and a lot of us have bought those. But it's actually a more efficient way to price our goods or services. It's more, you know, you can break it down more. So it can complement it, but you know how it's kind of cumbersome right now, the coins, and it is like a barter system. But like the founders prior to our beginning of our money, the country was operating on the Spanish milled pieces of eight. And the reason they called that pieces of eight, they had a hard time breaking that down, so they clipped it into eight pieces. It's an interesting story behind it. And so 2 bits was a quarter of a dollar. A dollar was that they weighed 371 1/4 grains of silver. And anybody heard that term, 2 bits, you know, it's not worth 2 bits or whatever. It's a quarter of a dollar. And that was, you know, the constitutional dollar. Our first dollar was 1792, I think. But anyway, that's what we're doing. I've been involved with recently.
Yeah, that reminds me of that.
Excuse me?
That when you mentioned bits, it reminded me of that the thing, shave and haircut, two bits.
Yeah. There you go.
Okay, and we've got, another. Joanna in Denver, North Carolina. She follows up on the previous question, I believe, here is what she's doing. So there isn't any militia in the States now. I never said I was interested in an anti-government militia. I just want to know if there is a way to find out if there is one now and how to get in touch with them to join.
Well, I'm not saying they're not all of them are anti-government, or wasn't accusing them of being anti-government, and they may not even be acting illegally. You know, most of them are trying to obey the law and everything, and so. But it's not what the founders spoke about. It wasn't these private groups forming. And yeah, there's a lot of them all over the place that have started. They don't know the history of what the colonial and state militias, what the Second Amendment really meant. But no, there's none that are today that are functioning state militia structures. And functioning within the towns or counties, you know, anywhere. They have one in New York. Well, let me back up a minute. Connecticut. I live in Connecticut. We have a Connecticut state militia. Okay, but it's only ceremonial. Okay, there's four companies. There's the governor's foot guard and governor's horse guard. They dress up in the colonial, the costumes, and they do parades. It's still left over from the colonial period, 1765 even, but it's not functioning the way it was supposed to, as providing public safety and security for the state or within the town and county level. So you have a thing in New York State. You have New York State Guard. That terminology, guard, came from the French National Guard. That wasn't formed. It started till the 20th century. So that's not what the militia is. I mean, for those that think the National Guard is the militia, that's not it. And it's nothing wrong with the National Guard, but it's a branch of the Army. It's the Army National Guard. It's really like a reserve unit of the Army. And the Army is not the state militia. So that whole thing is not properly functioning today. So.
Yeah, it seems to me, I think this is maybe what you're saying, and I'm just trying to bridge maybe the understanding to the person that asked the question. Mm-hmm. It seems that it's so grassroots, it's not top-down, it's bottom-up, mm-hmm. it's just mm-hmm. right at the local level, that they're not something that you're going to find commercials on TV. Come join us today,
no.
You know,
no.
It's just, or these real flashy websites or anything like that. You might... In your community of people, if you go to meetings, you go to activities, probably if you talk to a few people and ask them, somebody may eventually point you to someone that you can talk to that in the local area that might have a militia group of some sort. And that may be more the way it would happen rather than you do a Google search and voila, here it is right in my a few blocks away.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure it's going to quite happen that way.
Earl, I'm really strongly not suggesting that this is not what we're advocating, a local militia group.
Okay.
I don't know whether I've made that clear. I mean, that's not what the Second Amendment is, and that's not what, you know, these groups calling themselves, they could call themselves constitutional militia or whatever. That's not the way that they were structured. That's not what the founders envisioned. So I don't know. Maybe I'm an originalist. I believe our founders really what they were operating under and what we want to do, what committees of safety want to do, is that's the path we're taking. We're not advocating starting private paramilitary groups calling ourselves militia. I think they're very vulnerable. Unless, you know, I mean, you want to follow all the gun regulations and everything that are on the books today and meet some groups together. I mean, small groups, I mean, they're a lot of, you know, may not be illegal to do that. And there's some groups that are, you know, like Appleseed and stuff that train and, you know, marksmanship and everything else. They don't call themselves militia, but, you know, as long as it's legal, there's nothing wrong with that. But that's not what we're talking about here as a reinstituting the state militia.
Okay.
So
that's good. That clarification is real important. So I'm glad that we moved into that area. I'm sure we've all heard of different ones, and some of them have met with some real difficulties that have splashed on.
Well, look at Michigan. You know,
yeah.
they supposedly, I mean, I've seen this over the years, so many of them that have been infiltrated with agent provocateurs, and they're ending up like federal agents that have provoked them, and then they discredit the whole word, you know? I mean, the media loves to portray that. That's the militia, and it's really not.
Exactly. Well, that's good. It's an important distinction. Let's see. We've got, Frank in Long Beach says, how does the sheriff become the ultimate law enforcer of the land if it's not sanctioned by the Constitution?
It's by statute, which is a lesser law. The Constitution's the supreme law of the land, Article 6. And the counties and the state can put in whatever statute they want. Like I said earlier, in the structure constitutionally, in the original state militia structure under the Constitution, they were under that umbrella, the sheriffs and the constables, and later the police. For public safety and security, and the sheriff had its separate duties and responsibilities like the police, but they complemented one another. They were never superior or above the top law. I mean, they weren't above the militia anyway, the county militia or state militia. Okay, because it's a state institution. Like I said, you know, we didn't have the Western states. They weren't part of the colonial, the colonies, 13 original colonies. So when they came on board, they could put in, you know, statutes and everything. That all of the statutes has to be. It can't conflict with the supreme law of the land, the Constitution. So it's not like and Sheriff Mack even admitted it. He says, yeah, okay, it's not a constitutional office, but it's an important function, you know. I mean, that complements it. I don't know if I clarified that at all, but.
No, I think as we go along, it's clarified more and more. Maybe a couple more questions. I don't know how your time is. It looks like that we're at the right at the top of the hour.
You know the interesting thing about it, and it is the sheriff is important. You know, I mean, he's elected by the people. But what's so powerful about we get this state militia structure reinstituted at the state with our state legislators and governor signing on to that. When we elect, we would be electing all of our officers at the county level, so we'd have so many more offices elected by the people in that county, you know? And we would definitely have much more security and safety in that structure. I mean, it's great. I know there's some good sheriffs out there and that aren't going to oppress the people, but we know, like, within, you know, we have some that aren't good, you know, that are going along with this powers that be, that from the top down, you know, like some of the police too. We have good police in there, and then you got some that aren't, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's sad to see when the feds come in and they want to wreak havoc. They want to, you know, run roughshod.
They roll right over these guys. Yep.
Yeah, these guys just lay down and say, "I'm at your service." You know,
well,
saluting them and kissing.
And
them
a lot of it has to do with the purse strings. They're controlled by the money. Okay, or they're given, you know, some of them are bought off and buy them new sheriff's cars or police cars, you know, and it's all tied in with that money, too. That's why we need that independence there, an alternative monetary system based in gold and silver, too. So,
yep.
We have,
absolutely. We've got Chris in Maryville. If you can't touch the gold you now buy and own through investment changes and only have a certificate of gold in some account, what is the difference between that and any other promissory note versus real currency payments?
Was he referring to sovereign state depository? First of all, it's not a certificate. It's 100% reserve in that depository, and it's a third-party audit that's going to be done of it. Your gold is in your account that you physically hold, like some of these depositories that do this now, but you're also going to be able to use that as money electronically to purchase gold and to goods and services. And you can also, you know, you could keep it in Federal Reserve notes, or you can keep it in the physical gold. I mean, a lot of it, or silver. We're just hoping some, you know, we'll get some people to sign up and try it out. And you'll be able to preserve your wealth in that, some of it. Don't, you know, just try out a little bit. And not only are you going to be able to store it, but you can use it as money, too. And you'll be, gold and silver is good because it's preserving its purchasing power as the Federal Reserve notes depreciate. So this isn't paper gold or paper, you know, certificates or anything or promissory notes. We don't believe in paper money. This is a 100% reserve in that depository in your name in that account. Okay?
All right. We've got Rosie in Connecticut. And that's out your way. Who knows what city, but that'll be interesting. Do statutes need to be written into law at the state level first?
Yes. For the state militia to be reinstituted, yes.
Okay. All right.
The county and the town can't do that, but they can set up a committee of safety board and to show the state legislators, look, here's a good model. We've got, you know, the town selectman or the county legislator on this board. We have the police chief on the board. We have the sheriff on the board. We have advisors on the board from committees of safety that to provide for public safety and security that can complement the other first responders, emergency medical on the board, and to provide for the town and county public safety and security. So,
okay.
But the state militia needs to be done with the state legislators to put that in.
Well, this has been rather interesting, and I think people will find it refreshing, and I invite people to look into it more. It'd be great if you would give, Walt, if you'd give out your contact information for people to
sure,
follow up.
Sure. Yeah, I, you can go to committees, that's plural, committeesofsafety.org. You can find a lot of information. It's more a clearinghouse there for information. And a lot of good articles that Dr. Vieira wrote also on News with Views. He's one of the writers on there. Many articles on the proper militia structure he's got on that. And like I said, on our store page, you can also get that book. You can. It's about $20, the Constitutional Homeland Security that Dr. Vieira wrote, or you could write a check, and he has his mailing address. You can purchase it that way, too, so if you want a little more in-depth.
Okay.
Okay.
Very good. Well, I really appreciate you being with us today, and just wanted to mention a couple of things, and then it might be a good opportunity in just a moment if you have any final thoughts you'd like to leave us with. What I wanted to let everybody know is this has been recorded, so you'll find it posted at republicmagazine.com/webinar. And we want to invite everybody to join us next Thursday at the same time. In fact, just give you kind of a rundown. We do have the whole month booked, the Thursdays, each and every Thursday. We have Dr. Bill Deagle, MD, next week. He is actually going to tell us something very disturbing that, you know, I would say that it's, I don't know, I can't verify yay or nay. I would just say, you know, take it in and see how it rings for you. But it's very disturbing about some intentional mishaps and continuations of difficulties in a horrifically escalating situation in the Gulf oil crisis. That's all I'll say for right now, but what he has to say is pretty alarming, and he gets a lot of the information from people who are on the inside of that whole scenario. Then the week after that, we'll have Tex Mars. A lot of people know that name. He'll be with us to share some real information about the New World Order and some of the major players and exactly how it's being played out. We'll have, after that, we'll have Thomas Rogers. He'll talk about an incredible health threat and violation that is going on. John Rappaport is going to talk about, the next week after that, he's going to talk about the whole refreshing homeschooling scenario. And beyond that, we go into the next month with some other guests that are pretty interesting that we'll have more information on later. With that, Walter, if there's some final thoughts you'd like to leave us with, this would be a great time for that.
Yeah, the one other thing that our sister organization, I forgot to mention that again, it's sovereignstatedepository.com. It's SOVEREIGN, statedepository.com. You can go there and sign up. It's real simple. We'll send you an application we're working on right now. We've had to like navigate through all of these landmines to get this up and going, this alternative money system, because of the Patriot Act and everything else. It's been horrendous trying to get this set up, but it's easy. It's only for American citizens, the United States of American citizens and companies. And we'll send an application, and you can take it from there. And so I'd encourage everybody to go to that. And I want to thank you, Earl, for having me on. I've really enjoyed it. And,
yeah, it's been great. It's funny that what you just the information you just gave us, because it was right at the same time the last question came in from Scott in Miami. What is the URL of the State Depository?
Oh, okay.
Funny. Greg, right. Synchronicity, or whatever you call it. Okay, well, with that, folks, this has been a great webinar, and I encourage you to continue to follow up on this and go to Walter's website and check that out further. Also, share the replay with other folks and get the information out. And thank you, everyone, for joining us. We'll see you all next week. This officially ends our webinar. Have a great evening ahead.
Thank you. Thank you, Ron.
The moderator has left the conference.